91.9 WNRN Charlottesville.
89.9 WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg.
Listener-supported independent music radio, WNRN. This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you to everyone for listening today, WNRN Community Radio. I'm Rick Moore. This is the Sunday morning wake-up call. We're going to be talking about improving the lives of children with our guest today, Amy Woolard. She's from Voices of Virginia's Children. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It's a beautiful Sunday. It's not hot. I walked out of my house and I felt as though I was being I was just covered in butterflies. I have not seen so many butterflies in a long time. And as I drove here, more butterflies. I'm not sure what brought those out. Did you bring those to the station today with you?
It sounds like it's just your inner magic, Rick. Really.
Did somebody record that? Because I don't hear too many women saying that anymore. But yes, I'll accept that. My inner magic has brought butterflies out to the Charlottesville area. Again, Amy Woolard, she's from Voices for Virginia's Children, a nonprofit organization, I guess, based in Richmond. Amy lives here in Charlottesville. As we talk about improving the lives of children, write the phone numbers down because I think it's a topic that deserves a little conversation amongst the listeners as we go through the hour. 434-979-0919. You can also send us an instant message to WNRN Studio. All right, so, Amy, I want to jump right into it. Voices for Virginia's Children, well, you're talking about improving the lives of children. To me, that sounds like security, providing security for children. Is that right or wrong?
I think that's exactly right, Rick. I mean, we do work on topics that affect all families in Virginia and all children in Virginia. We especially focus on those that tend to hit our most vulnerable kids. And so for many of those kids, the issues are issues of security and stability, making sure they have their basic needs, access to education, access to healthcare, things of that nature that really we all need to thrive in our communities.
And Voices for Virginia Children, a nonprofit in the Richmond, Virginia area, but you cover the entire state.
We do, yes. We are pretty much the only policy, research, and advocacy organization that has a statewide view, and we take on those structural issues with that statewide view in mind. You know, as you know, Virginia is a very diverse state. We have extremely different issues in our rural communities than we do in our urban communities, in our northern section of the state versus our southwestern section of the state. But a lot of commonalities as well. And so our goal is to really look at the policies that can improve children's well-being across the state.
I didn't write down the website. Well, Virginia's Voices for Virginia's Children, I did. That's vakids.org. And there was a link somewhere in that group that took you to sort of data numbers that I found fascinating because it's broken down by a number of different topics. There's a conversation in there about poverty, and then some of the other conversations, topics that we'll be going through today. And then it went into the regions of Virginia. There was Northern Virginia, there was the Tidewater, the Southwest, and the Central, and then there's a fifth one is the South Side part of the state, I believe. And to just to read some of the numbers, the differing numbers on the topic of poverty, and how it was so much greater in the south side of Virginia than in the northern Virginia area. And in southwest Virginia versus Hampton Roads. And some of that, I would have said, well, of course. And other parts to that, I was fascinated by the numbers being so different than my stereotype.
Right. So we are the Annie E. Casey Kids Count Kids Count organization for Virginia. So Annie E. Casey is a national organization that looks at children's well-being. They measure it through a variety of indicators and end up ranking states based on performance in some of those categories. It can they look at economics, they look at poverty, they look at health, family, and community factors, and kind of do a calculus that brings them a picture of how we're doing in each state relative to children's well-being. And so we manage all of that data for the state of Virginia, and we also measure some indicators of our own to try to get a clear picture of what's going on with kids. And the topic of poverty that you mentioned is especially relevant now. Annie E. Casey just released their 2013 Kids Count data book that measures a lot of those indicators and puts states in rank with each other. And generally, Virginia ends up doing very well in those rankings, which is not ultimately surprising. You know, we're eighth in per capita income. We're a pretty resource-rich state overall. But what it revealed to us this year was that there are some pretty severe pockets of poverty that may be kind of averaged out when we look at a state view of how Virginia is doing. So you can get a sense of it even in the Richmond area, where you have Petersburg with a child poverty rate around 37%, and then Hanover County, just a few miles away, has a child poverty rate of 7%. So even in that small area, you see a tremendous disparity in how kids are doing that can kind of be masked when we look at an overall state picture.
Again, we talk about the data numbers, and sometimes it's hard to get the image in your head. For that, you can go to the vakids.org website, and it's pretty simple to find the numbers and the graphs that go along with that. But you talk about Virginia's ranking. And this little snip that I'm going to give you is what prompted me to call Virginia Kids and do this show. Virginia ranks 49th, the bad 49th, in finding orphaned children permanent homes before they turn 18. So let's talk about adoption and foster care, because that's a major aspect of what Voices for Virginia's Children takes on.
It is. We are 49th in what we call finding permanency for kids in foster care. So foster care is a system that's designed to be sort of a temporary stopgap for kids in crisis, in certain kinds of crisis. We want it to be very temporary. We want, ultimately, kids to be able to return to their families, if at all possible. And if that's, excuse me, if that's not possible, we want them to find permanent homes, either via adoption or via finding a relative caregiver who can take on their care. And so overall in Virginia, we have a relatively low number of children in our foster care system compared to other states. There are only about 5,000 kids in our foster care system. But every year we are hemorrhaging out kids who turn 18 while they're still in the system without finding them permanent family connections. So in the past few years, anywhere from 500 to 800 kids have turned 18 in the system and not had that secure family to provide stability for them.
Our guest today, Amy Woolard, she's from Voices for Virginia's Children. We're talking about improving the lives of children, currently about foster care. We'll get into adoption in just a moment. You're welcome to call us up with a question. I realize we haven't gotten very far, but write down the number, 434-979-0919. Amy, talking about the numbers and how you said about 5,000 kids. I have a hard time saying children, but it does. We're talking about, I guess we're talking about newborns to 17 years, 364 days.
We are, and the numbers can vary in those age segments. We have a lot of young people in their teenage years in our foster care system. That's one of those notions that tends to hold to the stereotype that we have a lot of older kids in care who are not able to return home, that we're trying to find permanent connections for. And even just recently this year, Governor McDonnell and his administration recognized that we were losing these kids out of the foster care system without connecting them to families and tried to shine a real spotlight on the need for finding adoptive homes for these kids through their Virginia Adopts campaign, you know, recognizing how important it is, even if we provide services and provide resources for kids, that those connections to adults in their lives, in their homes, is really critical to ensuring their success.
Take me through the process of finding a child, a foster care family.
Well, I think kids can come into the system in a variety of ways. The majority of kids we see in the foster care system come in under what's called an abuse or neglect finding. And that sounds very serious, and it often can be very serious, but it covers a wide variety of situations kids might find themselves in. Either something's not being provided for them in their home related to their basic needs. There can be issues of physical, sexual abuse. There can be issues of substance abuse, either with the parents or for a very small number of kids themselves. And so there are a variety of situations that can create the crisis that causes a family to either seek out or have social services come and try to figure out what's going on and try to make it better in the home and protect the child's safety and security. And so what we ultimately want is for kids not to have to come into the foster care system. Social services is tasked with finding ways to work with families to keep kids in their homes if they can at all be maintained there. And that's really what we want. The foster care system is a great stopgap, as I mentioned, but really it can be a system that sometimes creates more problems than it solves. And so prevention is really where we want to see resources and focus to make sure kids don't have to come out of their homes if they don't have to. If they do have to, you know, we can always use more foster families and more adoptive families to connect with kids. I think what we found through research is that kids do better if they can't be at home with mom and dad. They do better when they're staying with relative caregivers, when they're staying in their communities, when they're in a stable environment without having to move from place to place very often, which can create setbacks at school, setbacks behaviorally, and in other circumstances. And so what we try to work with departments of social services to do is to really find ways to make sure that there are good known families for kids to use as resources when they can't be at home.
Again, our guest today, Amy Woolard, will be talking about foster care at the moment. She represents Voices for Virginia's Children, improving the lives of children. Amy, I can only talk about this from my lacking point of knowledge, but when I think of someone, a child put into foster care, to me, my understanding or belief is that that's it. You're in foster care and you cannot or do not return to your original family.
I think that can be a misperception. Most of the kids who come in will have a goal of returning home to their family, even if they're in foster care. The family continues to receive services and resources, as does the child if they're in a foster home. And that's ultimately what we want to see for kids. We want to reduce the amount of time they have to be in care. We want to treat the problems and not the symptoms, if you will. So we want to make sure that we're really addressing the problems that are happening at home that created the situation in the first place, because ultimately that's going to be better for the young person in the long run. What we know about kids in foster care is that they face a great deal of barriers, even in the simple tasks that we all take for granted every day. When they're in foster care, their stability is often disrupted. They can experience school disruptions. As they get older, they're at greater risk for, you know, discipline issues in school. They're at greater risk the longer they stay in the system for things like dropping out of school, or if they age out of foster care, experiencing homelessness or unemployment or a lot of those really terrible outcomes that we don't want to see for anybody, much less young people that have had to be in a state system like foster care.
Some of the, again, my homework takes me to the website, vakids.org, Voices for Virginia's Children. And one of the a part that's in the legislative link says that, and this is a quote, Virginia should support policies that reduce barriers to kinship care. So, and you use the word barriers. What kind of barriers are there for kinship care? Because you also said kinship care earlier, which is you may have to, the child may have to come out of the immediate family, and is it better to go to an extended family caregiver? What sort of barriers are there to prevent that from happening?
I think, well, there excuse me, there are some legal barriers and legislative barriers, but there are also some sort of social perception barriers. I think a lot of what we tend to find when we support policies that are aimed at encouraging kinship care is that there's generally a view that families kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, need to take care of their own anyway. And so occasionally we have trouble finding state support for family caregivers who, you know, are kind of out on their own without those supports, even though they might be the best placement for a child. So, for example, this past legislative session, we championed a bill that was aimed at helping kinship caregivers perform the simple task of enrolling a child in their care in school. So prior to this past session, if a young person needed to go live with a family member for a period of time, that family member actually had to have legal custody of the child in order to enroll that child in the school division where they were living. And we felt that was kind of a critical exchange that had to happen for that young person just to be able to get into school. So all else being equal, the only barrier to that young person being able to go to school was a custody transfer, which, you know, from some legislator's point of view, didn't seem like such a big deal. What's the big deal about going to court and signing a piece of paper? But what we knew was that it was a big deal for families. A transfer of custody, even under the best circumstances, can create an adversarial issue within a family that wasn't there before. Any kind of court proceeding is necessarily going to bring up some issues that can create more disturbances in families than were there in the first place.
All right, our guest today, Amy Willard, representing Voices for Virginia's Children.
Support today for WNRN comes from the Jefferson Theater, presenting Three Sheets of the Wind with the Big Paycheck Friday, August 2nd. Three Sheets to the Wind plays classic songs from the 70s and 80s. Tickets for the August 2nd show are at jeffersontheater.com. Three Sheets of the Wind, Friday at the Jefferson Theater. Support for WNRN today comes from L. Oppelman, serving Lynchburg for 122 years. In addition to loans, L. Oppelman deals in jewelry, musical instruments, rifles, and handguns, game systems, TVs, cameras, and tools, with new inventory arriving every day. L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street, downtown Lynchburg.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks again for listening today to WNRN. And a special thanks to those in Richmond on 103.1. Don't forget, we are recording this show to be put up as a podcast later today on WNRN's site, also at Seville Podcast. Back with our guest, Amy Willard, here from Voices for Virginia's Children, as we talk about improving the lives of children. Amy, you made a reference about how some folks in the Virginia legislature were saying, what's so hard about going to court to make it so that the caregiver, the non-parent caregiver, can put the child in the school system?
Right. So I think, you know, it's always a delicate balance when we talk about state policies aimed at helping families improve the lives of their kids. Especially in Virginia, you know, we have a great appreciation for liberty and for, you know, sort of taking care of your family yourself and not needing a lot of interventions, and there's a lot of pride in that. And there's something to be said for allowing families the ability to make decisions for how they best function. And we always have to balance that, too, with making sure that families are able to access the resources and services they need to really make sure kids are able to achieve the best outcomes that we want them to be able to graduate from high school, to be able to go on to college if that's what they choose, to be able to get good health care. And so sometimes, you know, it can seem like we end up talking out of both sides of our mouths and how best to address the problems Virginia families have. But I think what we have behind us at Voices is a good deal of research and data that sort of guides us as to the best direction for the policies that we champion, especially in the legislature.
Well, one of the things that a question that I came up with is, you know, we talk about how one side of, you know, the conversation says, why is that so hard? And so I want to talk about the disconnect between those actually living or assisting the situation and those who sort of fall into the other side, not necessarily against it, but just who have thoughts on what could be done better and not always understanding the rules and how they happen. Typically, and you don't have to look very far in the political process to find someone who said, who stands up and says, those who are gays or lesbians, I think that they shouldn't have these benefits, until their child comes out and says, I'm sorry, Dad, but, you know, I fall into that conversation. And so you talk about a legislator not understanding what needs to be done to make things better and more effective, even though they may have a child, but the child comes from a very strong and all-supporting family.
I think that's one of the things that we really try to do, and I think one of the things that we are exceptionally positioned to do at Voices is reach out to legislators and provide them with information, not just the numbers and facts and figures and abstract policies, but connect them to their constituents, to the stories that really illustrate the need for the policies that we champion. We are a nonpartisan organization. We need both sides of the aisle to accomplish anything that we do. And the great thing about kids' issues especially is that anyone can understand them. You know, anyone who takes the time to kind of look at the picture that we're providing, to talk to the people, the families that we connect with, anybody can get that. And so it's our job at Voices, or part of our job at Voices, to make sure legislators have all of that information, are connecting with people who are directly affected by the policies that they are working with in the legislature, and really provide that clear picture of what's really going on in the state of Virginia. I think a lot of times, especially during session, it's easy to experience that disconnect when you're in the bubble of policy and bills and legal language. It's easy to kind of not step outside of yourself to connect with the people that you're representing. And so what we try to do is, you know, literally bring those people into the legislature and have them tell their stories and have them connect with legislators. And it really does make a difference. I haven't met one legislator, and I think I've met most all of them, who didn't find that meaningful and who didn't value what their constituents had to say about any particular issue. And so that's, you know, we're lucky to have that here in Virginia. We may not always agree on what the policy outcome should be, depending on who we're talking to, but, you know, I think it's a very receptive place.
Let's talk about mental health care. When I was sort of doing my research for today's show, I was surprised that was such a key aspect of what Voices for Virginia's Children does. I can understand the discussion about teenagers needing places to discuss their rough time in life, especially if you're an adopted or going through the foster care process. But it seemed to be on a grander scheme than I was understanding or had understood. So take over that discussion for me about how Voices for Virginia's Children helps with mental health care.
Sure. So At Voices, we also coordinate what's called the Campaign for Children's Mental Health, and that we maintain a separate site for at 1in5kids.org. It's called 1in5kids.org because we know that 1 in 5 children actually struggle with a mental health issue. And so while many of the issues we tackle at Voices tend to focus on vulnerable children, children in poverty or near poverty, what we know about children's mental health issues is that it really cuts across the economic spectrum, the geographic spectrum. If you think about the notion of 1 in 5 kids, that means, you know, everyone listening today knows someone or has a child that is experiencing a mental health issue. And what we also know about the mental health conversation is that we're still in a period of stigma. It's still, not polite conversation over the dinner table to talk about mental health issues, and that's something that we really want to tackle and make people understand that mental health issues shouldn't necessarily be talked about in a different conversation than physical health issues. It's all part of us, and we need our legislators, our policymakers, our communities to understand that these are serious issues that we have the ability to address if we make them a priority.
So when we talk about mental health care for kids under the age of 18, how do you, it just seems to me that when you talk about 1 in 5, that they're, and from a governmental standpoint, that there either has to be too few counselors and or a vast amount of red tape to make this a successful project.
Well, what we also know about that 1 in 5 number is that it equates to the number of kids who are accessing treatment for their mental health issues. So only 1 in 5 of the kids who are identified can actually get the help they need right now in Virginia. So it's a combination of what you're really talking about. It's a combination of needing to improve our system to best address the particular needs of kids, because as you can imagine, there's a whole spectrum of mental health needs. It's not just people who unfortunately are suffering from severe schizophrenia or other types of psychosis that have very severe needs, but it can run all the way down to kids who are suffering from anxiety and depression, and kids who don't require necessarily things like hospitalization or very severe mental health needs. And so what we try to do as well at Voices is to tackle both the stigma issue and the access issue. In the past couple of General Assembly sessions, we've worked off of a state report that helped to identify what are the big barriers to kids accessing mental health care in Virginia. And from that, what we learned, as you intuited, we have a severe shortage of child psychiatrists here in Virginia. It is a specialty that doesn't pull as many people in from medical school as we would like it to. And so the ultimate result of that is a lot of our pediatricians, our primary care physicians, are kind of having to serve as de facto child psychiatrists in a way. And so we want to both improve their knowledge when it comes to children's mental health, but also improve kids' access to child psychiatrists.
When we talk about mental health care for those under the age of 18, are we talking about kids who have otherwise been in the system of because they are adopted, because they have been through the foster care system, or are we talking about every child in the state?
We're really talking about all kids. I mean, the kids in the foster care system, kids who have been in crisis, are at greater risk and have some particular mental health needs that need to be addressed. But children's mental health issues affect everybody. And so when we try to improve systems for that kind of care, we are working to improve systems for all kids. So even families that have access to private insurance, a lot of times that private insurance isn't quite able to meet the true needs of kids that they're covering. So, that insurance can run out. It can not provide certain types of care that kids need. And the thing about mental health care is that, there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. Different kids need different types of interventions. We don't want kids to have to be hospitalized if that's not called for in their treatment. So, again, one of the things that we've tried to work on at Voices is to make sure there is that continuum of care for kids, and really all kids is who we're talking about.
Our guest today, Amy Woolard, she's from Voices for Virginia's Children. You can find them online at vakids.org. This is WNRN Community Radio, 1129. Amy, so let me sort of flash back. We were talking about legislative procedures for a simple thing like enrolling the child if someone not from the immediate family needs to do that. What happens when someone who's the caregiver, short-term, hopefully caregiver, for a child who needs mental health care? Where does the, whatever it's called, the health law come down in terms of the doctor sharing information with the short-term caregiver? Can things like this get in the way, or are there already...
I think we have some good policies in place for how to deal with those situations. We have, you know, federal laws that govern privacy of records and that sort of thing, and parents can really serve in that function to help create kind of a cooperative relationship to allow caregivers access to that information. When you're in the formal foster care system, again, we have other laws that kind of govern how records are shared in that context as well. And so I think there are always sort of improvements that can be made, but generally what you tend to hear with these issues are anecdotal stories that don't necessarily point to good policy. And so, you know, it's difficult to legislate by anecdote. We kind of have to look at policies that are going to improve the lives for vulnerable kids in a broader sense. And unfortunately, when anecdotes come up for kids that might suggest a different policy, we kind of have to look at that through a lens of, you know, what sorts of barriers they're creating and how we can best improve for the greatest number of kids.
Are there, and again, some of this, you know, my questions are anecdotal, but what happens if you have a family member who is not the current caregiver, who has a different view on how this should be taken care of? You very early on in the conversation about mental health, you talked about a barrier such as stigma. So the parent doesn't want the child to receive mental health care because, and maybe stigma is the reason, as opposed to the current caregiver, whether that's a foster family or the non-immediate family member, who says, you know, I think that's what's best served here.
I think in those cases, it's going to depend on where custody actually lies. And so until there's a transfer of custody, parents are going to have some of those rights. And some of that can drift into, you know, we were talking earlier about claims of abuse and neglect. And part of what neglect covers is the ability to provide basic care for a child. And that can include health care to a great degree. There are always some exceptions. You know, when you get into what's the best care, what's the best option for a child, there can be a variety of opinions on what that might be. But if it gets to a level of true neglect where harm can come to the child, there are definitely interventions that can happen in a family.
Again, our guest today, Amy Woolard from Voices for Virginia's Children, based out of Richmond, Virginia, talking about improving the lives of children in a variety of ways. 979-0919. That's 434-979-0919. Or send me an instant message at WNRN Studio, which I have in front of me right now, which is, what happens when a child ages out in terms of mental health care?
Well, that's a difficult question. When a child ages out of the foster care system, or when a child even reaches the age of 18 and they've been receiving... you know, they've been participating in Medicaid or things of that nature, there can be kind of a gap in care. Definitions for that apply to kids under the age of 18 and in the medical insurance context are often different than those that apply to adults. And so, you know, one of the things that the Campaign for Children's Mental Health is looking at is, how can we address that gap when kids turn 18 and make sure that there is a continuity of care? We know with the Affordable Care Act, starting January 1st in Virginia, when kids age out of the foster care system, if they turn 18 in the system, they're going to be able to continue to access Medicaid until age 26. And that was designed in the Affordable Care Act to mirror the provision that allows kids to stay on their parents' insurance until age 26. Because sadly, as we know, kids who turn 18 in the foster care system don't have that parental policy to stay on, and so we wanted to make sure those kids were provided for as well. But it's a very good point to bring up that transition age of 18 is really where a lot of our focus ends up at Voices in the mental health care context, in the foster care context. It's such a critical point for making sure kids are on the right path to achieving their employment goals, their higher education goals, and becoming productive members of their communities.
All right, 11:35 here at WNRN.
WNRN is brought to you by the Vinegar Hill Theater, Charlottesville's home for critically acclaimed cinema, now featuring digital projection. The Vinegar Hill Theater is at 220 West Market Street off the downtown mall. Now playing at Vinegar Hill, it's I'm So Excited. More information, including what's playing at Stanton's Visualite and Dixie Theaters, is at visualitecinemas.com.
Support for WNRN Today comes from the Modlin Center for the Arts at the University of Richmond, presenting music, dance, and visual arts. The 2013-14 season features the Steep Canyon Rangers with special guests Joy Kilsorrow, Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn, Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas, Roseanne Cash, Branford Marsalis, and many more. Details at modlin.richmond.edu.
And support for WNRN Today coming from TNN Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, TNN specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. TNN offers FSC-certified printing, an internationally recognized standard for production and consumption of forest products. TNN Printing can be reached at 434-971-8976 and t-nprinting.com.
Hi, I'm Vicki Simons from Piedmont CASA. Our organization works hard to represent children who are victims of violence, sexual abuse, and severe neglect. Sadly, there are hundreds of children who suffer from these experiences every year. Piedmont CASA provides these children with a voice in court. CASAs are court-appointed special advocates, and you can become a child's representative. This summer, Piedmont CASA will hold weekly information sessions. They will be offered every Thursday at noon and 6 p.m. Registration is required. Speak with current volunteers and learn about the wonderful work being done by CASA. Call 434-971-7515 for details or go online to pcasa.org. I'm Vicki Simons, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being here with us today. And Amy Woolard, Voices for Virginia's Children. That's vakids.org, as we talk about improving the lives of children in many ways that VA Kids does. I wanted to make sure we were talking about mental health for those under 18. There's an event coming up. We talk about legislating and et cetera.
Yes, there is. And so part of what we do at Voices, as I mentioned, was educating policymakers about our issues. And that extends to candidates as well. And so, as I mentioned, we are nonpartisan. We don't come anywhere near to endorsing candidates. It's our job to work with whomever is in office. And so it's really in our interest to make sure that everyone is prepared with the information they need, whomever is elected in November. This Monday, August 5th, coming up very quickly, Voices, the Campaign for Children's Mental Health, and our partners over at NAMI Virginia, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the Virginia chapter, along with more than 20 other organizations, are co-sponsoring a gubernatorial town hall, essentially, conversation in Richmond at the Collegiate School, their Oates Theater. It's going to be from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., again on August 5th. And it's an opportunity for both Mr. Cuccinelli and Mr. McAuliffe to appear, and they will be each answering the same six questions around all mental health issues, not just children's mental health. This will cover into adult mental health as well, and share their policy perspectives and what they will do if elected governor to address the mental health needs of all Virginians. And so we're very excited about that. It's free to anyone who wants to attend. We do very much encourage registration, and you can find registration information as well as information about the venue and the event on our site at bakids.org.
Being nonpartisan doesn't mean that you don't walk in with concerns or based on past, you know, each candidate's sort of past legislative behavior. Is there anything that any pros or cons that Voices is concerned about?
I think what we're concerned about are the issues themselves, and whomever is in office is going to be coming into a situation where they're really going to need to address these problems. And we have, you know, we feel like we've identified those problems. We have some ideas about policies that could be put into place to help address them. And so that is what we share with candidates and policymakers. You know, certainly there are policymakers on both sides of the aisle that have really risen to the occasion and become champions around children's mental health, around foster care. It doesn't necessarily tend to fall on party lines. Even in this area, you know, we have Delegate David Toscano, who's a big champion for children in foster care and children in social services systems. We have Delegate Dickie Bell in the Waynesboro, Nelson area, who's been a great champion for children's mental health issues and really helped our efforts to improve those policies in the past couple sessions. Senator Hanger is in this area, Delegate Landis. All of these people on both sides of the aisle have all connected with our issues in a way that's been beneficial to kids in the Commonwealth. So our experience, again, is that we need both parties to work on this. We have a legislature that is split in many ways, and so we can't get anything done without both parties understanding what we're trying to accomplish.
Again, Amy Woolard with us today as she's representing Voices for Virginia's Children, talking about improving the lives of children in a variety of ways. Amy, let's jump to juvenile justice, because as I was doing my reading for today, I came across an interesting segment that said, if I'll paraphrase, if foster kids' early connection to the system is through legal rather than school or other channels, that seems to put them on a different, often less successful path.
I think so. One of the things that we've tried to address is a term that's often used is crossover kids, and these are kids that have had involvement or have involvement with both the social services and the juvenile justice system. And as you can imagine, the trauma these kids have experienced, some of the choices that they've made, probably some of their school issues that they've had, have put them in a category of being especially at risk for very troublesome outcomes. And so we really want to make sure our most vulnerable kids, kids who are experiencing the most risk of these bad outcomes, have the supports they need to get back on track. I think what we do know about the juvenile justice system is that kids who have to experience periods of detention when they're in confinement, that can present its own difficulties, that can create its own problems for kids that may not have existed before that. So whatever we can do to address problems before these more serious consequences happen, the better. So a lot of times you'll hear people talk about how our jails and our prisons have become our de facto mental health hospitals. That's a very unfortunate truth. And that happens for kids as it happens for adults too. And so we support policies that aim to identify kids' particular issues or problems. And we support policies that provide appropriate solutions for those problems.
Is there concern or work put forth to the legal side of the system, and whether that's police, attorneys, judges, is there concern about any stigma being put forth there, where here comes someone under the age of 18 through my courtroom or in my police car, and that's going to lead they're bad kids, or they're going to be. This is just the first step, and let me stop this by putting them in prison.
I think you'll find some of that. I think we have really great judges and really great police departments that face a lot of challenges and barriers themselves to doing good jobs.
Voices for Virginia's Kids, is there some sort of manner where you step forth? Or are you training them and informing those folks as to what some of the numbers are and what some of the alternative courses can be taken?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that we've been really successful at is facilitating conversations between agencies. So a lot of times different subjects can fall into silos and not end up talking to each other. So there can be issues with the child that social services is addressing that juvenile justice folks might not have a good understanding of how those issues are impacting the behavior that's leading to court involvement. So what we try to do is paint a whole picture of the child, of the trauma that they've been through, of how that trauma might exacerbate some behaviors that lead to court involvement. What we want is for kids to be on track. We want them to be able to go to school, participating in their education. If there are special education needs, we want to make sure those are addressed, identified and addressed. And we want to make sure that there is stability in all of those critical areas of kids' lives. So if there can't be stability at home for the time being, we want to make sure that there is stability at least in school or in the environment where the child is staying at that point. We don't want more serious interventions or different interventions that are necessary to keep kids on track. So if a child has mental health issues, they're probably not going to be solved by juvenile justice solutions necessarily. We want them to be solved by mental health solutions.
We talk about many of the topics that we've talked about haven't specifically mentioned money and finances. But when you look at the legislative aspect of it, it seemed that the three or four from this past session that didn't require a lot of money were passed, and then one or two that seemed like great ideas were not passed because there wasn't funding, you know, already present for them.
Right. That's always a struggle. I think any time we can land on a policy that doesn't come with a price tag, we're pretty happy about that. It's a good indication, again, we get to circle back to talking about, you know, both sides of the aisle working on these issues. A lot of times we get a great deal of understanding from all policymakers, but it comes down to an issue of funding in a particularly difficult time. We're still crawling out of the recession. The state government is still feeling that very much. Because of, you know, sequestration and other federal issues, Virginia is trying to hold back some money and put more money into the rainy day fund to make sure we have sufficient funds in worst case scenarios. And so it's always a struggle to find the resources for these vulnerable populations that don't always have as strong a voice in our system as others.
And currently, I believe that Virginia is discussing, and maybe I'm missing the final decision, discussing opting out of the Affordable Care Act, which we chatted a minute ago about,
would be helpful to
those you know, kids. Instead of aging out at 18 and immediately being cut off from health care, they would give them until age 26 to do something and help themselves in some way or
right, and
other manners.
That will be in place. So the particular portion of the Affordable Care Act that addresses kids aging out of foster care addresses their ability to access Medicaid to 26 is part of the mandate, so that will come into play. What's currently still up for debate is whether Virginia will opt into the Medicaid expansion to allow, the around 400,000 currently uninsured Virginians to have access to the health care that they need. Voices supports it. We're a part of a group called Healthcare for All Virginians, the HAVE Coalition. Many of our great partners, the Virginia Poverty Law Center, the Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis, many, many groups have come together to try to help policymakers understand just what an opportunity this is to provide necessary health care for more Virginians. And it would bring more adults into the system, but it would also bring more parents of children into the Medicaid system that have fallen into that gap of not being able to access Medicaid, but also not being able to access private insurance or participate necessarily in the exchange. And we just think it's so critical for, especially for kids, to grow up in families where their parents are healthy as well. Parents are more likely to seek preventative health care for their children if they are also able to seek it for themselves and to have that mindset of being a healthy family as a unit.
11:50 here on WNRN, our guest today, Amy Wooler.
Support for independent music radio WNRN comes from Pocahontas Live, presenting Slightly Stupid with Atmosphere and the Budos Band on August 14th. Atmosphere and Slightly Stupid bringing a night of hip-hop and reggae to Pocahontas State Park in Chesterfield. Gates at 5, music at 5:30, tickets at PocahontasLive.com.
As we talk about Pocahontas, you want to check out the WNRN studio sessions on your YouTube channel. Bands like Alabama Shakes, Barnaby Bright, Robert Cray, and Wild Feathers, just a sample of the intimate studio sessions you can watch. Go to WNRN.org, see the Independent Music Radio's YouTube channel, made possible with support from TuneIn. And also next week, as we talk about entertainment, next week here on the Wake Up Call, I'll have the group Bar Hoppers. Used to be one of my favorite shows, Bar Hoppers, back in action. Local theater performed in area bars, usually six or so short plays. We'll have them doing snippets, talking about what Bar Hoppers is all about, giving them, I think the first show will be next Sunday night. But they'll be here first. All right, back the last 10 minutes of our conversation with Amy Woolard. Amy, you're talking about legislation, talking about budgeting. One of the things that you always see this when organizations with social issues, social help issues, such as Voices for Virginia's Children, talk about cost savings. Money spent now saves this much money later. And whether it's improving kindergarten, school knowledge, or mental health, not having the kids age out at age 18. Talk about that a little bit.
It really covers everything that we do, and it's a conversation that we always try to have with all of our issues. You especially see it, I think, in the early childhood care and education arena, where we really understand that investing in prevention, in early intervention for kids, can have a profound impact on their success later in life. We emphasize that with every conversation that we have. It happens in the mental health arena as well. The earlier we can get to kids and give them appropriate treatments, we can potentially avoid things like costly hospitalizations. Same with juvenile justice. A lot of the juvenile justice issues surface in the school environment, and we want to address things. You hear the term school-to-prison pipeline, and we see that quite a bit here in Virginia. There are discipline issues at school that are usually symptoms of some other crisis going on, whether it's a special education need and the child is unable to connect with the classroom because they don't have appropriate interventions there, or if there's a trauma or a crisis at home that they're unable, quite understandably, to leave at the door, the schoolhouse door, presenting itself as discipline issues at school that then we're seeing result in actual charges, something that maybe when you are you or I were in school might have gotten in school detention for or after school detention for. I don't know.
I was never in detention ever.
I'm not pointing any fingers at Rick. You know, now result in actual, essentially, criminal charges for kids that are following them throughout their life. And so I think the more that we can intervene early and actually identify the issues that are happening with kids and come up with appropriate solutions, it is going to save us money later on. It's hard to quantify for policymakers, you know, the cost avoidance that happens post-18, the cost avoidance that we would experience if kids are in jobs as opposed to homeless or in school as opposed to in the justice system. But we know that there actually, even in addition to that, are cost savings in making sure appropriate interventions are put in place.
You use the word appropriate, but I would assume that there are a number of people who would say that is the appropriate manner. What we're doing now is the appropriate way to do this.
Sure, but I think that we need to look beyond the immediate situation into what's going to make the difference for these kids for the long haul. So in the mental health context, one of the issues that the Campaign for Children's Mental Health worked on was to gain more funding for mobile crisis response. When kids have mental health needs in their home, but it may not have risen to the level of a need for a serious intervention like a hospitalization, because of money that the General Assembly has now allocated for more and better mobile crisis interventions, teams can actually come to the home of a child in crisis, perhaps de-escalate a situation, figure out what's going on in that particular instance, and avoid a more knee-jerk reaction of, you know, let's get these kids out of our sight. Because they certainly aren't out of mind. They don't go away when they go into detention. They don't go away when they go into foster care. They don't go away when they have to be institutionalized for mental health reasons. And sometimes severe interventions are necessary, but I think what we've found is we can't do this one size fits all. We can't be punitive and restrictive and expect kids to recover from that and suddenly become, you know, the great citizens we want them to be.
11:56 here on the Wake Up Call. Just a few minutes left with our guest Amy Woolard from the group Voices for Virginia's Children. You can find their website at vakids.org. You know, Amy, there's so much depth to this conversation that I'm looking at my notes and going, oh, yeah, poverty. You know, how can we talk about what I consider to be, and whether you do or not, but to me it seems to be, if not the main root to the tree, certainly one of the big roots to the tree. Oh, yeah, and we got 3 minutes left. Go ahead.
I'll just solve it right here. No, I think, I mean, you've put your finger on a great portion of the problem. There are more than 280,000 kids living in poverty right now in Virginia.
Does that include the near poverty group? We always hear about that recently, about the families living paycheck to paycheck may not be in poverty,
right?
But it would only take that one or two paychecks to put them in poverty.
That's just in poverty. So that's not even that near poverty figure. That's one in six kids across the state. And again, as we talked about early on in the conversation, in certain regions of the state, you know, in Petersburg, it's one in three kids. In Southwest and Southside Virginia, it's about one in four kids. So we have rich pockets of the state, and we have pockets of this extreme poverty that can lead to essentially trauma for kids. I mean, growing up in prolonged poverty, kids are at greater risk of health concerns. They're at greater risk of going down a path, you know, being forced down a path, essentially, that they can't escape from, that's leading to unemployment, that's leading to justice issues and things of that nature.
But that takes me back to one of the earlier parts in the program about the disconnect between what the legislators may feel is an important part of the conversation as opposed to something that they think is being solved over here. And I would make a good guess that the 140 Virginia senators and state representatives, not many of them are currently living in poverty, even though they may see it more in their section than someone else does. And so how do you sort of grab them by the shoulders and say, maybe not in your family, but turn this way and look over here.
Right. I think that sometimes we literally have to lead them there. So the Campaign for Children's Mental Health will do things like sponsor tours of our hospitals and intervention centers for legislators to actually show them how their money is being spent, how their money might be spent better, the need that's out there. We try to get them in conversation with people who have those needs and hopefully absorb that particular experience in a way that they can internalize and understand people's experience who are perhaps different from them. It's a difficult haul. I mean, I think it's difficult for all of us who aren't living in poverty to keep that in mind. I think it's an active mindset that you actually have to make yourself pay attention. And so we certainly encourage policymakers to do that. We will send them information, send them news clips, bring them to areas of their constituency that we feel like they need to see to help inform their decisions.
Yeah, we need to continue this part of the discussion on another day. I hope you'll come back.
Thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Amy Willard, she's from the group Voices for Virginia's Children. You can find their website, vakids.org. Thanks for listening. Les Temps-Perdue up next. And next Sunday, we'll have the Bar Hoppers with us. Thanks for listening.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlotte.